Passage then, we're in 2 Samuel. We didn't quite finish it. Oh, that's 1 Samuel. That's why that doesn't look right. The paragraph heading was Jonathan that I turned to there and said, well, we shouldn't really be encountering Jonathan at this point. All right. We're in the end of chapter 19, right around verse 41. 2 Samuel, yep, sorry, 2 Samuel 19. David is returning home from his short exile in Mahanaim over on the... Oh, you guys can't see. Oh, computers. Let's do this. And now you should be able to see. There it is. Okay. So, Mahanaim is over here in the land of Gilead. Let me shrink some of those names. Try and clear it up. I wish I could select individual names to show you, but this program just doesn't let you do that. So if you want the cities that David visited, you got to look at all of them. Right? So Mahanaim is right here. This is where David hid from Absalom during the time of his exile there. We're not sure exactly how long that time was. Probably didn't last more than a few months, though. Just enough time for Absalom to gather Israel together and fight the one battle in the forest of Ephraim. So David is on his way home now. He has come down south here, and he crossed over the Jordan River here around Jericho and Gilgal. So I'll zoom in a little bit so we can see this trek. Descend into the Jordan River Valley, and he crosses the Jordan here. It was when he crossed the Jordan that he ran into several characters that we looked at last week. One of them was Ziba, the servant of Saul, who, when David was leaving Jerusalem, had told David that Mephibosheth, his loyal friend, had betrayed him. Well, now we find out that's not actually the case. Ziba had betrayed Mephibosheth, so David had to deal with that situation. And you also had another fella from Benjamin who, when David was leaving Jerusalem, his name just slipped my mind. Shimei, that's it. Shimei, when David was leaving Jerusalem, Shimei had thrown rocks at him, cursed David's name, said he was rightly enduring the judgment of God for slaughtering the house of Saul, which was not true, but Shimei thought it was anyway, so he was cursing David as he left. Well, now Shimei is one of the first people to meet David and says, you know what, I was just fooling, you know, you're a nice guy, David. And so he's begging for his life at this point, which David grants. All right, so all along the way here from the Jordan River, people are coming to meet him. And we have the statement in verse 40 that the king went on to Gilgal, and Chimham went on with him. That's the son of Barzillai, a man that helped David while he was in Mahanaim. And all the people of Judah, and also half the people of Israel, brought the king on his way. Everything's just seems like it's going great. David's being received back into his throne, welcomed with open arms by the people of Israel, right? So you have all the people of Judah, you've got 1,000 people of Benjamin, about half the rest of the people of Israel. So, big crowd. I mean, talk about a parade. Hundreds of thousands of people lining the way here, escorting David and cheering him on. However, true to David's life, nothing's going to remain easy for very long. Right? You ever feel like that? Just when things start to go your way and start to go good, there's another major problem. And you say, oh, come on, couldn't I have had 6 months of peace? Really? But that's not the way the Lord allows us to do it very often, is he? Because he wants to grow us. And so David's got another growing experience to go through here, because verse 41, all the men of Israel came to the king and said to the king, why have our brothers, the men of Judah, stolen you away and brought the king and his household over the Jordan and all David's men with him? Oh, a little bit of tribal jealousy. This is an age-old tribal jealousy. As it is, it's going to culminate in the absolute division of the kingdom after David's son Solomon is on the throne. When Rehoboam becomes king. The northern tribes completely split off and form their own kingdom. And Judah and Benjamin are left to themselves in the south. So that's going to be the culmination of this tribal jealousy. But it's present even now as the people of Israel are looking around and saying, wait. How come Judah gets the place of honor? How come they're the first ones to bring you over? And they even have a couple of arguments against it. down just a couple of verses, which we'll get to, but they specifically bring up the point, hey, we were the first ones to talk about this. If you remember, after the battle of Ephraim, the forest of Ephraim, Absalom's dead, his army's been scattered, David's still sitting over in Mahanaim, and he starts hearing rumors that the people of Israel are beginning to discuss bringing him back as king. And he has to send envoys to Judah and say, hey, how come you're not talking about bringing me back? Well, that's what prompts Judah to bring him back. So now that he is coming back, Judah's the first one on the scene, and Israel comes a little bit later, and they get there and find out he's already being escorted from the Jordan, and they have missed a place of honor. Well, they're very, very jealous about this. You see some of this kind of stuff, political stuff all the time, don't you? You know, you didn't set my plate quite as close to the president as you did the person on the other side. I'm very insulted by this. And, I mean, they have to consider all this nonsense, and you just want to smack them upside the head sometimes. Say, seriously, grow up a little bit. But that's the way it goes. Everything is perceived as a slight. Every little nuance can be construed as an insult, right? And so that's what Israel does. And so David gets to see here how slight his hold on the kingdom is, because this fight erupts. This rebellion begins to erupt. All right. So the men of Judah respond in verse 42. They address David. They want to know how come Judah gets the place of honor and we don't. So the men of Israel hear this. I'm sorry. The men of Judah hear this, and they answer the men of Israel, because the king is our close relative. Why then are you angry over this matter? Have we eaten at all at the king's expense, or has he given us any gift? The implication there is David hasn't given us a thing. We're not receiving anything by being in this position. He hasn't doled out the presents. He hasn't even made a meal. Oftentimes the king would do that. He'd open up the public stores and he would present gifts of food and wine and other things to the people. But he hasn't done that because he's been exiled for the last months. He doesn't have access to the public treasuries yet, does he? He's trying to bring his government back to the capital where all those things are. And so Judah's answer, what are you people upset about? We haven't received a thing out of this. So are you greedy? Is that it? You want a gift? You want some kind of a present? We haven't gotten anything. And he says, besides, the king's our close relative. David's from Judah. We're from Judah. Why shouldn't we be the first ones to be there? Well, this does not quite appease the people of Israel, because verse 43, the men of Israel answered the men of Judah, we have 10 shares in the king, and in David also we have more than you. Why then do you despise us? Were we not the first to speak of bringing back our king? And so here this argument just continues to go on. And the argument now is, look, we're all Israelites, but we're 10 tribes, so we have more people than you, so we've got a bigger share in David, right? Kind of the same reason that if you look at a political map, what color is Illinois? What color is most of Illinois? It's red. And there's a couple of blue areas, right? But so many people live in those blue areas that it dominates the rest of the state. Well, it'd be kind of like saying, you know, we elect somebody to office and everybody in Chicago comes out and says, yeah, you know, we got 10 parts in this guy. You've only got one. And I don't know, you might say, fine, keep him. But, right? You know, it's kind of some of the same reasons that West Virginia split off of Virginia back right around this time of the Civil War, because they said that the philosophy and the people was so different. You hit that Appalachian mountain range and there's such a difference in philosophy. They said, look, it doesn't represent us to be one state. Let's separate into two. We got plenty of room, and you want slavery in Virginia because of all the plantations that are there, and we don't want it here in the mountains. We don't have big farms. We don't need it. And so they separated, and you have Virginia, and you have West Virginia. Which, by the way, what is his name? John. Almost Heaven. I can't think of his name. John Denver. He sings that song, Almost Heaven. It's kind of the state theme song. He's not talking about the state of West Virginia. If you'll note it, this is just one of my pet peeves, by the way, so I'm going to go off on it. Okay? He says, Almost Heaven, West Virginia, Blue Ridge Mountains, Shenandoah River. Neither of those landmarks are in the state of West Virginia. They are in Western Virginia. So he's singing about Western Virginia, and John Denver wasn't alive when the divide happened. Okay? So Almost Heaven is Western Virginia, not West Virginia. He should have enunciated clearly, and I'd be less annoyed. Okay. Oh, also on songs, I was thinking about this while we were singing, that Higher Ground is a great song. We look at it and say, it's because I want my faith to be growing, right? I want to keep climbing up the higher ground. You know, the original intent of that song comes out of Methodism, but it's a brand of theology called Keswick theology. It's about these big spiritual meetings they used to have all over the country called Keswick meetings. But it taught that you could reach a place of sinlessness, and they call it that higher ground. So you could by praying and reading your Bible and doing spiritual disciplines, you could get to the point where you would reach a sinless state in your life, and that was the higher ground. So just don't sing it with that intention, because that's bad theology, all right? But it still is a good song, if we just change what they mean. Okay, anyhow, I'll continue on here. We're in chapter 20 then. So taking advantage of this quarrel that's happening, there happened to be a worthless man there. That term, worthless man, is a fun one in Scripture. It literally is translated a son of Belial. You'll see this in the New Testament as well. When they're trying to find false witnesses against Jesus, they hire sons of Belial. And Belial literally means worthlessness, but also came to represent the name of some local demons in Israelite understanding. There, you know, Satan is the chief of the rebellious angels, and he has several sub-generals under him, and they named one of them Belial, worthlessness. Anybody ever read John Milton's Paradise Lost? So Satan has fallen into hell after his initial rebellion, and he's gathering all of the rebellious angels to him to try and determine what their next course of action is, and it starts naming them all. And John Milton ascribed to all these fallen angels the names of all the gods of the old world. And so he says Beelzebul was there, and Marduk was there, and Chemosh, all these names of the gods of the nations around Israel, and teaching that each of those demons, when they did get out of hell after their rebellion and get to the world, they all established themselves in certain localities and became the objects of worship of the people there. Interesting little tidbit, but off the point, I suppose. Son of Belial happened to be there, a worthless man, not a description that you want to be called, whose name was Sheba, the son of Bichri, a Benjaminite, and he blew a trumpet. Why? Probably he had the trumpet there initially to celebrate David's coming in, but blowing the trumpet was a symbol to call the people to the action that you are proposing. And so he blows the trumpet to draw people's attention to him, and here's his message for the people of Israel. We have no portion in David, and we have no inheritance in the son of Jesse. Every man to his tents, O Israel. Now what is that a call to do? Revolt. Forget this guy, we're done. Now, just a few minutes ago, they were all arguing, don't we have 10 shares in David and you've only got the one? And now all of a sudden, Bichri is able to stand up and say, or Sheba, the son of Bichri, stands up and says, never mind, we don't have any share in David. You Judah people, you want him, you can keep him. Let's all go home. We'll pick our own ruler. Well, who do you think that ruler's supposed to be? Well, you know, if I blow the trumpet and say, let's revolt against our government, probably I want to be the ruler. And so it's going to turn out to be. So verse 2 is really the more amazing part. All the men of Israel withdrew from David and followed Sheba, the son of Bichri. They listened to him. This turmoil within the tribes of Israel has gotten so big that they are willing to depart from David. And so all their talk about bringing David back to be king is really shown to just be surface. Their hearts are not exactly with David at this point. Can you imagine trying to take rulership over a country that you knew most of the people didn't really want you there? I don't know, maybe that happens every election. You realize, well, let's see, 100 million people voted. How many percentage of the vote did I get? And, all Israel withdrew from David. So you have to imagine this scene as they are there at Gilgal, and there's huge parade was escorting David up the road from the Jordan to Gilgal, and then it's going to continue on down to Jerusalem. And all of a sudden, Sheba blows this horn, makes his statement, and now this mass of people is just moving off and starting to wander up the road into the hills by themselves, and they're no longer escorting you. And so David's watching his hold on his country slip away again. This just happened. The same thing happened. Of course, it was unbeknownst to him when Absalom did it. Absalom did it by trickery, by deceitfulness, right under David's nose. Well, here it's very overt and very blatant, but it's still happening again. And so David, just imagine this up and this down he's on. David, you're the king. Everything's going pretty good. Oh, your son wants to kill you. Rats, let's run. So we run. Oh, we won the victory. God's done it. Well, your son's dead, but at least you're going to be king again. But okay, now the people want you to come back. So all right, we're going to come back. Oh, never mind. They don't want you to come back. I mean, it's just up and down and up and down. And so David's watching as all these people begin to depart for him. So the men of Israel withdrew from David and followed Sheba, the son of Bichri, but the men of Judah followed their king steadfastly from the Jordan to Jerusalem. So they escort David from that river all the way up the winding road to Jerusalem. A very uphill climb, kind of a winding climb too. I mean, it's back and forth across the hills, and eventually you make your way all the way up to Jerusalem. So what a mixed feeling David's got to have here as he finally gets to go back home. But when he gets home, you realize your hold on the kingdom is very, very slim. Well, he's got another thing to deal with when he gets home. This is one of those days you just really feel like you didn't want to wake up. You know, it's just, can I go back to bed, please? Try to start this day over because this is going bad. Because here's what happens when he gets home. Verse 3, David came to his house at Jerusalem, and the king took the 10 concubines. Oh, yeah. Remember them? When David fled from Jerusalem, he left 10 of his wives at home to keep the house. Do you remember what happened with that? What did Absalom do? Yeah, pitched a tent on the rooftop so everybody would know it's happening, and he went in, slept with his father's wives, and so that all of Israel would know that his commitment to rebellion was pretty firm. Well, now what are you going to do? David comes back home, and oh, that's right, I've got to solve this problem now. So it's just one thing after another with him, but he's got these 10 wives. That he has left there, whom he left to care for the house, and he put them in house under guard and provided for them, but did not go into them. David can't claim these women as his wives again, because they've now been claimed by Absalom. All right, so that's an issue he's got to deal with. So here he puts them in a house, he puts them under guard, he provides for them, but he's never going to go into them as a husband to a wife again. And it says that they were shut up until the day of their death, living in widowhood. And so there's how he's going to deal with these poor gals, these 10 gals that went through that experience. So he's going to provide for them. They're going to be well taken care of, but they are going to be treated as widows for the rest of their lives. Verse 4. Now he's got to deal with the big problem. The king said to Amasa, you remember Amasa? Amasa was the general that served Absalom, but when David was coming back up to Jerusalem, he promised Amasa that he would be general in place of Joab. Joab has aggravated David his entire life. It was Joab that wanted to kill Saul those couple of times in the cave, and while Saul was lying on the ground sleeping. It was Joab that killed Ishbosheth's general when David was going to try to make that man king. It was Joab that ordered the death of David's son. So David's had just about enough of Joab. And so he finally says, I'm going to make Amasa king, general of the army in Joab's place. And so he did that. And so the king gets to Jerusalem and says to Amasa, call the men of Judah together to me within 3 days and be here yourself. So what's he need the people of Judah for? They are his friends and his relatives, and what does he need them for? Yeah, it's fighting time. We got to put down this rebellion fast. David realizes he does not have a stronghold on the country, and so if he doesn't put down the leader of this rebellion quickly, that everything's going to start falling apart. So he needs to show himself to be a very strong leader at this point and go after Sheba, the son of Bichri, and get him quickly. So he gives Amasa these instructions. Get Judah here within 3 days. That's all the time you've got. Now, that's pretty reasonable amount of time as Amasa would send out his messengers to all the cities of Judah and say, send your men in. We've mentioned this before. They had sort of a militia system set up where every family would have to contribute men, depending on the need. Sometimes they would call out every able-bodied man if the need was really big. Sometimes they would call out a certain number. But if you were between the ages of 20 and 50 and the call came out, you had to pick up your weapon and go, right? And so he calls out the people of Judah. He needs a big army. Now, understand, too, that Judah is typically, just about every census that we get, Judah is outnumbered heavily by Israel. Because you've got 10 tribes up here in the north, and you've just got Judah. Judah's a very numerous tribe. They're much larger than any of the other single tribes, but altogether, they're generally outnumbered by heavy amounts. And so he calls all of Judah together, call the men of Judah. So verse 5, Amasa went to summon Judah, but he delayed beyond the set time that had been appointed to him. This is one of those points in Scripture where I really wish we had a detail. What happened? Why does Amasa take longer than he's supposed to? We can guess, but we're not really sure. Maybe the men of Judah really didn't want to listen to Amasa. After all, he was the leader of the last rebellion, right? Under Absalom. Maybe he was just not all that vehement of a character and took his time. We don't know. There's 100 things that probably could have gone wrong, but whatever it is, Amasa in 3 days is not back at Jerusalem with the army, and that is a that is a problem. So David said to Abishai, now Abishai is Joab's brother. I have a feeling that David is still not speaking to Joab, but that he is around. And we're going to see that he is around. He shows up here soon. So David says to Abishai, now Sheba the son of Bichri will do us more harm than Absalom. In other words, this is a real, real problem. We cannot let this man go any longer. We've got to go get him. So Amasa hasn't done it. Now he gives orders to Abishai, take your Lord's servants and pursue him, lest he get himself to fortified cities and escape from us. Verse 7 is going to explain for us a little bit of what he means by take your Lord's servants, right? Judah has not been assembled yet. He doesn't have the militia coming with him. So who does he have? David has a standing army of a few men, remember? They went out with him when he fled Jerusalem, and they're listed in verse 7. There went out after him Joab's men, and the Kerethites, and the Pelethites, and all the mighty men. So David has this standing army of mighty men. It's at least few thousands of people, and they're the best. They're the strongest men David's got. So he's at least going to send them. That's why he says to Abishai, all right, we don't have Judah. Take my servants and go get this guy. So he calls together the Pelethites and the Kerethites. But who's the other list there? The mighty men. And there's one other group of people there. It's the first one listed. Joab's men. Anybody think this might be a problem? I want you to go get Joab's men. Now, Abishai is Joab's brother. So Joab's men probably would be somewhat loyal to Abishai as well. But this could be a big problem. Because if they're Joab's men, they're probably a little more loyal to Joab than they are to David. Right? So this this is a tenuous situation that David's having to juggle here, but he's got no other choice. He needs an army. He's got to go get Sheba before he gets fortified. And so he sends him out. So get these people. Verse 7, they went out from Jerusalem to pursue Sheba, the son of Bichri. And when they were at the great stone that is Gibeon, Amasa came to meet them. So here they are, they're gathering together at a place at Gibeon, which was a common gathering place. Now, Gibeon is just about 7-8 miles northeast of Jerusalem. Right here is Jerusalem. And then you come up here to Gibeon. And so there was a big rock there that they used as a gathering place to muster their armies. So they all went there, and then they're going to leave from that place and go pursue Sheba. Well, guess who shows up? Amasa. He said, Amasa, where have you been? You were supposed to be back here by now with an army, and he comes back without an army. Well, he might have the army with him, I guess, but he comes back, but he's late. So they were at the great stone that is at Gibeon. Amasa came to meet them. Now, Joab, here's our mention of him, which I do find interesting because he is present with the army. He was probably present or at least nearby when David gave the orders, but I can just see David looking right past Joab to Abishai. You know, tell Joab to get the army ready, and he's standing right there. You know, you see these joking things about married couples having fights and looking at the children and say, tell your mother there's no way I'm going to do that. And she looks at him and says, well, you tell your father. It's like, well, I'm standing right here, right? So Joab is present. He is on hand, except now David is doing his business through Abishai, Joab's brother. So Joab is present at this rock of Gibeon where all of the mighty men and the soldiers are gathering. And here comes Amasa walking towards him. How do you think Joab feels about Amasa right now? Based on Joab's history, give me a reasonable hypothesis of what's going to happen in the next few verses. Abishai is Joab's brother, Amasa. Amasa's probably not going to fare too well. We'll read on and find out. Joab was wearing a soldier's garment, and over it was a belt with a sword in its sheath fastened on his thigh. And as he went forward, it fell out. So the picture is he's got all his armor on and he has his sword strapped to his belt here. But as he's going forward, the scabbard and the sword fall out from under the belt and land on the ground. Perfect opportunity for him to pick it up and have it in his hand and not look too suspicious, right? Because, I mean, somebody's walking towards you and you pull your sword out, that's a little threatening. And it might set Amasa into a defensive posture. But he's just picking up his sword off the ground. I mean, that's nothing threatening about that at all, right? He dropped it. Yeah, what kind of good soldier drops his sword, right? So, this is what the sword fell out as he went. And Joab said to Amasa, "Is it well with you, my brother?" Oh, you sly fox, my brother. How tender, how endearing, how snake-like. Right. And Joab took Amasa by the beard with his right hand to kiss him. Now, any of you guys tries to take me by the beard later on and give me a smooch, and we might have issues, okay? So, but it was a common form of greeting. When you had kinsmen or people that were just dear to you, you would grab them by the beard and you'd kiss each cheek. You still see them do this in some countries today. It's not like you're laying a big smacker on their lips, okay? It was kind of that you touch your cheek and you on each side. So that's what he's doing. So he grabs Amasa by the beard with his right hand. But what's he got in his left hand? Sword. He's got a sword. But Amasa did not observe the sword that was in Joab's hand. Why? Because he dropped it out and he just picked it up. So it didn't look threatening at all. But he's got this sword in his hand. Now, we tend to picture medieval long swords, like these big, long, slender things. It's not what the ancient swords looked like. They were about yay long. much shorter, but very maneuverable, usually sharp on both sides. And so he's got this sword in his hand. It would have been very easy for him to maneuver it. And maneuver it he does. Joab struck him in the stomach. And for the weak of constitution, you can cover your ears. All right? If you don't like gross things, don't read this next part. But here's what God tells us. Joab struck him in the stomach and spilled his entrails to the ground without striking a second blow, and he died. Blah. Right? So Joab strikes him in the gut, tears that open, and all of his insides start to come out. And of course, that's going to end your existence here. We could ask our EMT how long that takes. I don't know. You've probably never seen that. Okay. We don't do this too often, but it happens, all right? So there's Amasa laying on the ground in a pool of his own blood, and he's dead. Now, this is the second time Joab has pulled a stunt like this. And each time it was because somebody was threatening to take his job. And so he took matters into his own hand. He's a violent man. He's a revengeful man. And you see him executing it again here. Then Joab and Abishai his brother pursued Sheba the son of Bichri. So they are ready to do David's bidding. They're ready to cement control of Israel back under David's hand. And I don't doubt that there is a lot of Joab sort of holding this over David, saying, hey, who's the one that's really got control of this for you? All right? Who won back Israel from Absalom? Who won back Israel from Ishbosheth for you? Who got Israel back from Sheba? It was Joab. So he's probably trying to position himself as the guy David can't do without, right? But he does it. So they're going to go get Sheba, the son of Bichri. Verse 11, one of Joab's young men took his stand by Amasa and said, whoever favors Joab and whoever is for David, let him follow Joab. Now, why do you suppose he's got to stand there and say this? Yeah. There's going to be a ton of confusion. Who do I follow? Because David put Amasa in charge. We all know that. When David was coming up from Jerusalem, he sent the envoys ahead and said, Amasa, you're going to be general in place of Joab. Everybody knew Joab was not on David's highly favored list at this point. Everybody knew that Joab is the one that killed Absalom. But there's Amasa, and he's dead. And so they're all standing there. In fact, it says, verse 12, Amasa lay wallowing in his blood in the highway, and anyone who came by seeing him stopped. Because it throws your mind into a little tizzy. So, wait a second, isn't that our general? Aren't we supposed to be following him? Probably he does have the men of Judah with him. He's the one that summoned the armies of Israel. He's the one that had the marching orders, and now he's dead. What do we do now? Chain of command is an important thing, isn't it? You get into the military, and what happens when the commander dies? You were just talking about that show, Designated Survivor. So what happens if the leader dies? Well, in every authority structure in our country, we have very clearly labeled chains of command. So if something happens to the president, who becomes the leader? Automatically, vice president's in charge. His decision is now law, right? What happens if the vice president gets killed? Speaker of the House. What happens if the Speaker of the House gets killed? What's that? Well, I think from there there's a list of cabinet members. And I'm ashamed to confess my lack of civics understanding there. But beyond the Speaker of the House, I'm not sure who it is. They probably don't know either, yeah. But there is this contingency plan, right? So if the general of the army gets killed, who's next in line? The assistant general, yeah. Right? That's why we have the ranks. We know the authority structure. So privates, even private first class, do they give orders to corporals? Doesn't happen. Well, they can try. They'll get in trouble, right? Do corporals give orders to sergeants? No, that goes the other way. Sergeants give orders downward, right? So sergeants, do they give orders to lieutenants? I had a friend who was a lieutenant in the Air Force, and he had just been commissioned, and he had something to do with the sergeant major. And he says, "This was really tough, Brian, because I recognize I'm technically over him, but this guy's been in the Air Force for 20 years. There's no way I'm going to issue him a direct order." So you sort of understand, but the authority structure is there. So if the lieutenant who's been in the Army for 2 months gives an order, the major general who's been in the Army for 20 years has to listen, doesn't he? And so we have this authority structure. Well, they didn't quite have it worked out that much at this point, and it was in confusion because Amasa's the leader, but now he's dead. And so Joab takes control of things. He usurps his position here. One of his servants stands there and says, "Whoever's for who?" Look at your text and look at who he says. "Whoever is for Joab." Ah. Now we see who this is really about, don't we? Men of Israel, Amasa's dead. He's laying right there in a pool of his own blood. Who are you going to follow? Do you support Joab? Oh, and by the way, if you support Joab, who else do you support? David. But who's listed first? Joab. Joab's a self-serving man. He really is a self-serving man. So he has a servant stand there. And when everybody's coming up on the dead body and they all stop in astonishment, it says, "When the man saw that all the people stopped, he carried Amasa out of the highway into a field, threw a garment over him." Nice way to treat the general. "When he was taken out of the highway, all the people went on after Joab to pursue Sheba, the son of Bichri." And so here we have David caught in the middle of another rebellion and another betrayal. He's tried to deal with Joab before, and it always goes badly. Every time David tries to restrain this man, he just explodes further in his rage. But David's got problems right now. He needs to cement control of the country. He needs to reestablish himself as king, and in order for that to happen, Sheba needs to be stopped. And so probably when he hears about this, he has to just let it go for a little while, because he doesn't have the power, he doesn't have the heart of the people to be able to take care of it the way that it should be taken care of. And so he's dealing with more rebellion and more betrayal. So that brings us to the end of that section. Next section, next time we'll finish squelching a rebellion. See how David deals with Sheba, the son of Bichri. Any questions?